Welcome to SciGuys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Luke Cutforth, and special guest, the fifth SciGuy, Noah Finn.
Hey!
Number two!
This week we're talking about social styles and regulation in relationships, but first, we have a wee YouTube comment. This one says, redistribute the ADHD, in all caps.
That would have been me.
Well, it's from Noah Fince, yeah?
That was a quote from Luke Cutforth over here.
Yep,
I just copied it.
But before we get into the show, we've got a question for you to answer, and you can answer that in the YouTube comments or over on Spotify. And if you're not on either of those places, well, here's what you do. Raise a child. It's going to be hard. It's going to be rough. You're going to love that child unconditionally. Sometimes you might not feel that way, but you always will. And when that child grows up after you've, you know, raised them from an egg or however kids work, they will have the answer to your question deep within them. Send that child to us and, well, I guess we'll get the answer. The question is, what's your attachment style?
Secure.
Is it? I've listened to your music.
Yeah.
That sounds very convincing.
My parents are great. I have a great relationship with them. I'm just not secure in myself, I think, is what you're hearing.
Luke, what's your attachment style?
I don't know what they are, so I can't really tell you, I'm afraid.
Well, Luke, you'll be about to find out what they are right now. What's attachment theory? Do either of you know?
Okay, so this it sounds like one of those things that's not a real thing. Like, it's all a bit woo-woo-y, and it's not very precise. It doesn't really predict for anything, but I also think probably it's not that, and it probably actually is a real thing.
I know the answer.
Okay, ooh. I'm going to respond to what Luke said, then you can give the answer. I also thought that this was just nonsense, like kind of like Myers-Briggs personality types or the five love languages, both of which we've done episodes on, by the way. I thought it was more akin to that, where it was coming from a non-science angle and, you know, trying to pull in the sort of scientific stuff. But no, this has been science from the start. I had no idea.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I just thought it was like another like brand of horoscopes. You know, this is my attachment style. I am a Libra Pisces. That means something. But I don't know what.
Go on then, what is it?
What's attachment style, Noah?
So some psychology guy was like, right, I'm going to figure this out. We've got some problems in the world. People arguing all the time. Let's see how we can, you know, sort that out. He said, so there's this theory that your relationship with your first caregiver has an impact on the rest of your relationships and the rest of your life. So if you have a bad relationship with your mummy and daddy or gender-neutral parent from birth, you will have issues in your adult relationships.
That sounds like it makes sense.
Yeah.
That means sounds like you don't need a scientist to say that, you know?
Yeah, well, that's why I know it right now.
Yeah. So if we go from Britannica, their definition of attachment theory is the theory that humans are born with a need to form a close emotional bond with a caregiver, and that such a bond will develop during the first 6 months of a child's life if the caregiver is appropriately responsive. Very interesting, right? You know what any of that means?
No airing your baby's texts.
Oh, wait, like ignoring them. I was thinking airing bad laundry. Like, look at this text my baby sent me.
You said airing.
So needy.
Don't
so
ghost
demanding.
Your child.
You said laundry. I just pictured a child doing this, getting all the water off it.
So, the history of attachment theory. You kind of got into this a little bit. Do you know the name of the guy that developed it initially?
Bowlby.
That is so true. It was John Bowlby. And I'm glad you said it because I did not look up how his name was pronounced.
Was it Bowlby? Bowlby.
Well, if you got it wrong, blame Noah. So
you're the science man.
Not the name man, am
yeah.
I?
Yeah.
You're the one out there collecting names.
Yeah.
How many do you need?
Two?
Noah and Vince.
So he basically developed this theory, like you were saying, Noah. He was looking at how when infants were removed from their parents, that they would kind of go a little bit nuts. You know, they'd be crying, as babies are wont to do, looking for their parents, as one is wont to do when one has lost something one wants. And they basically would try to avoid being separated from their parents and try and get back to their parents once sort of separated or once they're back in some kind of proximity with them.
So clingy.
Yeah, specific barriers put in place between the baby and the parent that the baby wouldn't go through. So like hurdles or something. a wall.
Was this like a baby Olympics, Corey?
Did they get through a brick wall? Like, would they swim?
So to my understanding, they would just have the mother leave the room. So I guess the barrier you're talking about would be a door?
Did any babies manage to get to their parents?
Like those cats that can open doors on TikTok.
I feel like we're misunderstanding what's happening here. This is not a baby Olympics where we separate babies from their parents and the first one to get back to their parents wins.
Yeah.
I would have thought that would be more entertaining.
Can that be the quick fire quiz instead this week?
Which of you can get back to your parents as quickly as possible?
Yeah.
That's just because you'd win that right now. You'd win that.
Oh, I'm going to see my parents tomorrow, so I would win.
Dear.
So, it's not about testing babies to see how quickly they can get back to their parents. It's about removing babies from their caregivers to see how they react. So the idea initially was that these sort of reactions were just sort of defense mechanisms that were sort of trying to get rid of emotional pain. But if you look across like loads of mammal species, you will find that, you know, that is like sort of consistent across mammals, right? That babies will try to get back to their parents. And they will be in a state of sort of distress when removed from their caregivers, you know, like at a certain point. And essentially crying and searching are the two sort of main responses. Does that make sense to either of you?
It makes total sense.
I'm really confused.
Can you give an explanation as to why crying and searching might be something that a baby does?
To avoid emotional pain. I was joking when I said I was confused. I thought you were gonna, it was funny to me. Sorry.
I was trying to be nice and protect your emotions, and there you are.
My emotions are fine.
Are mine. So, do either of you have any idea why that might be the case? Why crying and searching might be things that babies do when removed from a caregiver?
Well, the crying helps parent find you, mm-hmm. and the searching helps you find parent.
Yeah.
There are two people involved in this.
And why is finding caregiver a good idea?
Because you are useless. You are a little baby. You can't do anything.
Pathetic.
Very hurtful words, you guys. Very hurtful.
But you're so small.
You can't do anything.
Boy. I can do lots of things. Why are you being so cruel to me? Why are you being cruel to me specifically?
Cry about it. Go look for your mum. Doing the searching mode. Woo.
Right, so I'm going to get back to this if you're done with your nonsense now. Yeah, the idea is that this would have evolved basically because it is useful in terms of if you are loud and staying in one place, you're easy to find, like a smoke alarm. Or if you're looking around to find something that you've lost.
You might find it,
like a smoke alarm. You could lose a smoke alarm.
You're a top 20 science podcast. Like, if you are loud, people can find you easy.
Like
science.
A smoke alarm.
Sources in the description.
So
citation needed.
the idea is that was sort of naturally selected to sort of help survival, to keep infants and babies and whatnot close to the folk that are going to be stopping them from dying. You know.
Yeah. So there's loads of babies that didn't try and look for their parent and didn't make any noise.
I mean, they
weren't very successful.
I guess, evolutionarily speaking, at some point, yes, there must have been some mammalian species that didn't. Maybe there was a mammalian species that didn't cry or didn't cry as much, you know? Mm. And that, like, whatever caused that would have been selected against, yeah. But, I mean, if we look across the entire sort of animal kingdom, this sort of parenting that mammals, and I guess some birds do, that we do, is not, you know, the norm necessarily, or is not a standard that all animals sort of match, right? Specifically reptiles and amphibians, a lot of them, they're like, I did all the birthing. So you're on your own now, right?
There's lots of cute videos of ducks doing this though, so.
Well, ducks are birds.
That's true.
The ones that I mentioned earlier.
I was just thinking about mammals, sorry. Penguins, I think. Oh, that's birds.
Another bird, yeah.
It just doesn't feel like a bird, but it's a bird.
So moving on again, attachment and detachment. Does that mean anything to either of you?
Yeah, you're attached to something, you can become detached from it. What do you mean? Does it mean anything?
No, I got you on this episode because you demanded to be on it because you liked and
yes,
knew about attachment theory.
The question was so open.
Okay, so attachment is basically, I guess, exactly what you're describing. Being attached, and so when you are away from something, you want to be back at it. Like emotional attachment, as opposed to like physically being attached to something. And then detachment is that like the state of not being with the caregiver? Or is that like the state of like not caring anymore because you've given up? and it just everything doesn't matter, and you've sort of emotionally numbed yourself, and so you don't try. Like when you leave babies to cry themselves out, you know, that horrible process where you're like,
oh, that process that we probably should not be doing. And there's been, I think, quite a bit of evidence for quite a while that it's not great for babies.
I've heard that they stop crying eventually just because it hurts so much.
Yeah, do you know what? Like, we'll go through the stages. We'll go through the stages. Yeah. And do you know, that's the interesting thing, right? We've done this on the podcast before where we've where we've sped up or pitched up me pretending to cry. And I don't think people realize that babies, when they're crying, it is just a baby like shouting. If you pitch down a baby crying, it sounds like a person shouting. So they're just shouting. They're just small, and so their voices are high. And it sounds weird.
It
to
sounds
have to
like
bring
an
up.
Adult man going, like he's just like bashed his shin and going
and like shouting, right? And like it's weird. It's weird to feel the need to mention this, but I just think people don't really register that the only difference between a baby crying, I guess, and an adult sort of shouting and making that noise is that babies are smaller and so make
That makes it actually kind of more sad.
Yeah,
that
right?
They're just going,
literally, they're just screaming.
I like that, like, babies specifically have very shrill screaming voices because it means their parents are more likely to hear them because it's like a certain frequency. Do you think in the past there were babies with really low voices that just didn't?
A mom!
Which way is it? Is it not more that the parents who are more sort of attuned to that sort of frequency are less likely to have their babies eaten by a crocodile?
Or maybe they're just disgusted
that's the
by
selective
their children's
pressure,
low
by
voice.
The way. The universal selective pressure, babies being eaten by crocodiles. But I don't know. Like, which way does it go? I mean, it's probably both things, right?
Yeah, I'm guessing babies like sort of like moved towards a niche, like a frequency that there wasn't a lot of interference in, which cats also then joined them in, bastards. Yeah. And then also parents, like the parents that were particularly attuned to the frequency of their child. But then interestingly, there are like animals, I don't know if we do it, but like animals where like they can differentiate the cry of their baby from other babies. Mm. Especially, I think maybe it might be penguins, I can't remember, where like if you like have your baby with loads of other babies, like you all sort of like hang out together with all your babies in a big sort of baby party, then you need to be able to differentiate your baby's cry from other babies' cries. So they can. It's amazing.
Can humans not do that? I mean, I don't have a baby, so I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe, we'll find out one day when we have baby, but like...
When you and I have baby together.
Me and Corey have had a baby.
Congratulations, I didn't know.
We'll do a scientific test to see if we can tell it from other babies' cries.
Yeah, after the test to figure out how the two of us managed to produce it.
I could make the baby cry if you needed help with that.
Well, how would you do that?
Oh, just like...
Just his presence.
Cruel words, mostly.
Cruel words.
Cruel, mean thoughts and words. Oh, you're really insecure about yourself. You should be.
I don't think
right
that would work
that.
On a baby, no.
If I say it enough.
Well, it works on the baby he sees in the mirror every day. Anyway, we'll talk about that sort of process of attachment, detachment. Essentially, Bowlby kind of brought it down to asking whether if the attachment figure is nearby, accessible and attentive. A lot of what I've got here is coming from Britannica and a few other places, by the way, so head down to, you know, the sources to find all of that out. But yeah, the idea is if they're nearby, accessible, attentive, right? So you could be nearby and not accessible, right? The baby's not able to get to you because there's a barrier in between, as Noah was pointing, like hurdles, little baby hurdles.
Like
maybe
a cot.
Can't get over them.
What is a cot but baby hurdles?
Don't give them
baby
ideas.
Cage.
Baby cage, that's
the topless
true.
Baby cage. Well, the babies don't need to be topless in the cage, but the cage itself
topless
is.
Baby cage.
It's not weird for a baby to be topless. In fact, it's very normal for a baby to be topless. Don't make this weird.
Why are you putting them in cages then? It's very normal, Corey.
Because they keep on trying to escape, Luke. They keep trying to run away, or crawl away, or roll away. So baby hurdles, as we were saying. There could be something, that, like some kind of barrier that's making them not accessible. And attentive, right? You know, they could be accessible. You could be nearby them, but they could be a terrible parent. That's a possibility also. Or, you know, they could have something else going on. You know, parents can't be there for the kids all the time. Babies are very needy, Luke. Anyway, the idea is that if the answer to that question is yes, then you're going to feel good, you know? Name some good feelings you might feel if your parental figure, like, you know, is nearby, accessible, and attentive.
Safe.
Really?
Yeah.
That must be nice.
Comfortable.
Oh, wow. God, wish I had that. Any more?
Not anxious.
Secure.
Oh, wow. All of these seem like lovely things. Yeah. So it sort of results in a feeling of being loved, confident, secure. And, you know, if you're feeling confident and secure and safe, how do you think that impacts your sort of behavior, specifically as a baby?
You take risks.
Well, yeah, actually, no, genuinely, yeah, right? Because as a baby, you don't understand anything. And, you know, even some adults understand very little, Noah. And, you know, so what that leads to is them exploring their environment, putting things in their mouths, you know, just trying to figure stuff out. Mm. And a baby is more likely to be sort of, I guess, exploratory would be the word. If they have that secure attachment with a sort of parental figure or a caregiver, right? Because, I mean, it makes sense. Because, you know, if you're not worried about sort of survival, or you're like, I feel safe, then you're more able to be like, oh, well, let's see what this thing is, because I feel safe.
Yeah.
But if you're scared and you're like, oh, I don't know, like, I don't have any like safety net, or like there's nothing here to protect me, you're not going to be like looking out for more stuff because you're going to be scared.
Yeah. I suppose if you frequently, I don't know how baby psychology works. I don't know how smart they are, but like
I don't think they're very good at psychology, Luke. I think the field is primarily filled with adults.
Okay.
Yeah. That's from the studies that I've been looking at. Yeah. Not a lot of baby representation in there.
All right. Well, more research is needed, but, if you frequently find yourself like your caregiver has left, and you frequently find yourself back in like that searching mode, I guess you're also constantly anticipating that the parent might leave, and so not only do you feel less safe to do things, but you're also constantly anticipating not only that you are in searching mode, but that you will be in searching mode. And so you can't ever chill out, because you might suddenly be unsafe if you stop paying attention.
So you're looking for obstacles to overcome, and they're not coming because you're a baby. Are you also like more likely to like make friends in school and preschool because you're more comfortable?
Oh, I never did that, so I'm not really sure. No,
make friends.
Nah, mate, nah. But to be honest, right, like we'll get to the sort of ramifications of this in just a sec. I just want to go through that process we were talking about leading up to detachment, so we can see whether Luke's answer was correct or not, because I'm sure we've all forgotten what it was. But yeah, no, the idea basically behind this is that if you don't have a strong attachment or a good attachment to a parental figure, or a caregiver rather, you know, at that sort of critical period, it's going to have an effect on just how you deal with relationships and how you deal with things going forward from that. So if we sort of look at it as separation and then despondency, then detachment, those would be sort of three broad stages of what happens when a sort of child is separated or doesn't have that sort of affirmative answer to the question that Bowlby posed, you know, the sort of is a caregiver nearby, accessible and attentive, right? If the answer is no to that, then this will be sort of the experience, right? So what happens when you basically, you know, you take a kid away from their caregiver, their parent?
Well, they scream.
Yeah,
like quite loudly, and they wriggle.
they basically give off the idea that they're not having a good time. They let everyone know about it. And this is like, this can happen even if, you know, you're with a stranger, or whether the kid is alone, right? And Bowlby's ideas behind this were essentially what we've kind of already touched on, which is if you are loud, you will be found, right? It is beneficial to your survival if, when separated from a caregiver, that you make it known. Because, you know, maybe they're busy. Maybe they haven't noticed that the baby's just kind of disappeared. And, you know, especially with sort of us as humans, we don't cling as well as some other mammals, or primates specifically. We don't cling as well as some other primates do. Do you know what I mean by that?
Mm.
You're very clingy, yes.
Don't know about that.
As babies, I should say. Okay, right. How about this?
But I think there are some, are there not some like tribal communities where like the mother like literally has the baby like attached to them at the breast for like 6 months or something, and they literally just carry them around all day doing all their normal stuff that they do, but the baby's literally always attached to them?
Yeah, attached to them. I mean, maybe that's the case, maybe not. But yeah, like being attached, like having the baby close by is a thing that you need to kind of actively do.
Yeah.
Whereas with a lot of sort of other primates, they will cling. Right.
Oh, you mean literally?
And if we talk about like sort of other sort of mammals, if we talk about sort of horses,
monkey.
And Well, no, because I've just spoken about primates. I'm saying other mammals. Like, quite literally.
Sorry.
We've both done it now. No. Yeah. I mentioned birds.
Just the one.
Monkey.
So let's say, giraffes or horses or whatever. They're able to sort of run, like, get up and walk and move in that way pretty quickly, right? And with primates, they tend to cling for a while. And with humans and, other sort of mammalian infants apparently as well, but we're talking quite specifically about humans here. With humans, when they're separated, they will scream and want to be found because you want to be close to the caregiver. That's kind of what I'm talking about there, bringing in all the other animals, that all of these are things that keep you close to your caregiver, make you able to be looked after by them. And so because babies are, honestly, the babies will just die if left unattended, you look at a baby the wrong way and it's like, oh great, now I broke you, gotta do a lot of work to fix that, right? Like, babies are hardy, they got a few bounces in them definitely, but they're also very easy to break. That's the main thing there, and so they need other people to care for them so that doesn't happen. And we know this is all very obvious, but this is the sort of evolutionary pressure to make sure that happens. That's the idea there, right? And so when you're separated, that's what happens. There's just this immediate sort of protest to it. And then if you go sort of past that, if you're screaming and you're crying and that stops, that's not working, they're not going to continue doing that. The second stage would be sort of despondency or despair. And at that point, they just do nothing, really. It's kind of what you were talking about earlier, Luke, where they just kind of sit, they go silent, and they don't do anything. Can you think of why that might be useful? Like, after you've been screaming and crying and making a whole bunch of noise, to suddenly go quiet and not move.
Maybe they think they're annoying their parents, or their screams and yells are... And what would you do? Will you give me a face? I mean, if I was a baby, I was screaming all the time and nothing happened, I'd be like, okay, I'll stop the screaming. Maybe the screaming scared them off. Maybe they don't respond to screams.
It's more that your attachment style probably isn't as secure as you were saying up top. But
no. Well, I think the only thing about that, the reason I find it funny is because I think that requires too much complex thought on the part of the baby. Because I don't think they yet will be thinking of the parent as like another person with its own wants and needs and thoughts. But I would say maybe because it makes you vulnerable to predators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, if we're talking that sort of evolutionary pressure, right? If you're screaming and crying and no one's come to get you, if you keep on screaming and crying, someone's coming to get you, and it might not be the person that you want, right? It might be that crocodile we were mentioning earlier. If you think about a baby in an environment where it's not built for a baby, right? It could be the forest floor. It could be anywhere else. Moving around the law and screaming, it's going to potentially cause injury. I mean, the screaming, obviously attracting other predators or whatnot, but the moving around, right? Like, babies don't have much control of themselves. They can maybe crawl, and sometimes they can't lift their head up. Like, depends on how old they are, right? And if you're in that situation and you're kind of rolling around and moving around, there's sharp stuff. There's dangerous stuff. You could be on a cliff's edge, a very, very terrible parent leaving a baby on a cliff's edge, Gonna pop. God, left the keys. Have to pop back to the house. You stay here. but do you know what I mean? So it makes sense to then go quiet and stay still. And that's kind of like advice that's given, whether you're lost at sea or whether you're lost, anywhere else. Stay put.
Become despondent baby.
Well, yeah. Stop being a little baby and become a baby. So yeah, you stay still and stay quiet. And then if that doesn't work, if the baby's still separated from the caregiver at that point, then, they'll then move into sort of detachment, right? So after that sort of period of sort of depression, despair, despondency, whatever you want to call it, if that sort of continues without any sort of reconciliation with the parent, then you'll enter sort of detachment, which is essentially the baby just getting on as normal. So just trying to be independent, do their own thing without help from the caregiver. And the idea behind that is that essentially, right, like, what else are you going to do, right? Like, okay, well, I screams, I've done that, step one, check. I've sat still and done nothing, step two, check. I'm going to, it's almost the same as, if you were suddenly stuck upon a desert island,
yeah.
Luke, What would you do?
Firstly, you try and make like a flare or like spell SOS out in pebbles on the sand, all the other things they do in the TV shows. And then I guess I'd be like, oh God, all hope is lost. I'm so depressed. There's no point. And then I might be like, right, is there any nice fruit around? And then go eat some fruit.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's the three stages.
Noah, you've been watching a lot of Lost recently. Is that what you would do?
I'd probably do the same.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah. So if you think of it like that, you know, you try and get help. Help doesn't come, and you're like, okay, quiet, because might be more dangerous. And also, I'm feeling sad and whatnot. And then after that, after a period of like, you know, just nothing happening, then that sort of bond, you kind of sever that emotional bond there, right? And you kind of get rid of it almost, right? Mm. Like you don't then have that close bond with the caregiver, even if the caregiver were to come back.
Wow.
Because you've gone through that sort of process. And Bowlby kind of thought of it as basically you can't form new attachments until you've sort of shed those old ones. You just get rid of the ones that you've got with the previous caregivers that have left you in that situation. And then, you know, you might be, then be able to form attachments with new caregivers, right? So let's say another, like, you know, two folks that aren't... Well, yeah, maybe an uncle, but also just like anyone sort of going by that isn't your initial caregiver, even if you were to, say, not know them, right?
Yeah.
Like, you would then be able to form that emotional bond with them, and they could then be your sort of caregiver. And that emotional bond is important, obviously. It's a case of, like, how do infants deal with this? And we're talking about infants here, to be clear. How do infants deal with this situation where their caregiver has kind of essentially been removed from them? Like, how do they carry on surviving?
That's interesting, because my instinct would be that they would actually, like, lose faith in attaching at all. Mm. Like, they would not be able to... And maybe that's what we're going to explore. Like, maybe they're less trusting of future attachments than they would otherwise have been. I'm sure that is... part of it. Mm. But it's interesting that they still have the instinct to attach. And it's probably in part, maybe like inversely correlated to like how capable they are. Like if they're really young, if they're like still like an absolute tiny baby, you can try all you like to do what you can to stay alive, but there's really nothing. Your best bet is still, hello, would you like to care for me? Because I can't even crawl yet.
I'm very cute. Look at me. Look at my little face. Is it not strange that my head is most of the size of my body? Yeah, no, exactly. Spot on. And yeah, I mean, like, that's sort of attachment through to sort of detachment. And the idea kind of didn't stop there. Do either of you know anything about Mary Ainsworth?
No.
Yeah, I remember the name.
Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
I think it is, but it's rather quiet this time.
Well, Luke, we want to keep a big old secret about this Sci Guys merch.
Yes, please do not tell anybody and do not purchase any of it. Otherwise, people will find out.
They might see you wearing our merch or displaying our merch and think, oh, wow, what a cool person. And I'll tell you this, as a cool person myself, having people think you're a cool person can be very, very stressful.
Yeah, we can't have that. And we also can't have you supporting the show to exist that you're enjoying right now.
Yeah, so absolutely, under no circumstances should you go to normalcitizen.store and pick up some Sci Guys merch. Some Sci Guys merch like beanies and posters and t-shirts and calendars and cool stuff like that. Definitely don't go to that store and buy that.
Goodness me, that's an awful lot of stuff that I'm not going to purchase.
Absolutely, Luke. Now let's get back to the show before anyone listens to us.
God, I really hope we got away with that one.
Mary Ainsworth, did she come up with like three different attachment styles? Is that her?
Yeah, so she was the one that kind of picked up where Bowlby left off and went into the different styles of attachment. And, you know, it's really one of those things where you come across this, right? And a bloke has just done a bunch of work. And then, you know, a woman comes along and does a lot more work. A lot of the time, that woman will just be kind of like forgotten. Mm. But there is a lot, when you sort of read about this, yes, there will be places that are just saying, this is John's thing. This is John Bowlby. He did this. But a lot more, I found, were kind of putting them on par with each other because she built off of his work, but built it kind of more to what it is today, right? And they were colleagues, and she then started, like, actually studying this. So beforehand, it was Bowlby just kind of being like, this is an observation. this is what I think. You know, this is the situation. I think he was maybe doing some experiments as well, but it was Mary Ainsworth who specifically started studying, like sort of rigorously, scientifically, infants separated from their parents. And that's how we kind of got the idea of attachment styles that we have today. Do you know about the strange situation?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to tell me about the strange situation?
I probably don't remember specifics of it. I remember it being like a large scale study where they put a bunch of parents in their own room and then the parent left and they studied what the baby's reaction were and then they put them into different categories of like how attached they were.
Yeah.
But they were also, they were told like, don't respond to your baby's screams. Is that...
You made it sound very dark at the end there. You're like, yeah, no, that's exactly it.
Yeah, that sounds like they're torturing the babies and they're like, don't listen to the baby. He's making it up. Don't worry.
Don't worry. But no, it wasn't... it was in some way baby torture as far as this podcast goes.
Emotional baby torture, yeah.
Do you know what? I was very chuffed with how they treated these babies in this, because a lot of the time when we're looking at how babies are treated in science, it's they're mentally torturing them just to see what happens. With a fear response, or they're raising them with a chimp that at some point will be able to rip their face off.
That's
and
a
say,
good one.
This is your sibling. Or other such things. Anyway, they didn't do any of that to a baby. It's exactly what Noah was saying. They had a room. They probably had many rooms, but let's just talk about one room for now. They had a room. They had parents. I think in this case it was mostly mothers, or it might have been entirely mothers, but at the very least, there were a fair few mothers there. It does say parents a lot, and this can apply to fathers, but because of how babies tend to form that sort of closer emotional bond with the mother, I think they were looking specifically at mothers. Yeah, they were looking specifically at mothers. And I don't know whether this is sort of a genuine specific thing of this is how babies attach to mothers, or whether it's just that mothers are more likely culturally, you know, to sort of... be the ones that have that sort of high level of interaction with the babies, and therefore,
it's like a primary caregiver thing, right?
Yeah.
Rather than it being a mom, the first attachment that you form.
Well, yeah, and mothers tend to be, you know, the ones that are breastfeeding the kids,
yeah,
usually. So, or bottle feeding, or feeding the kids, and that obviously forms a bond there as well. So they took a bunch of mothers, they got a bunch of babies, and they were like, let's see what happens when we take these two groups apart, when we remove them from each other. They basically just want to see how kids reacted, sort of how they regulated themselves, what they did, and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So there was 12 to 18 month old kids, so that's 1 year to like a year and a half, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I can do maths. That's maths. And so, yeah. They took the mums and they took the babies, they put them in a room, and they ran this test. So this was in 1971. They had about 100 middle class American families, mothers and infants. And they basically designed this so that they could figure some stuff out. Like the actual quote that I've got in my notes here is, the strange situation procedure was designed to be novel enough to elicit exploratory behavior and yet not so strange that it would evoke fear and heighten attachment behavior at the outset. So essentially, like, it's got to be unfamiliar enough that this baby looks at it, like, is in the situation, is like, I want to see what's going on here. I want to learn, but not so unfamiliar that the baby's like, mummy, please don't let me be in this place alone. I am terrified. I don't want to learn because it's scary.
Yeah, it's just like they're not holding the mom up at gunpoint. They're just telling her, hey, you may want to leave a little.
I love how you think the baby would be like understanding what gunpoint meant.
Well, American babies, probably.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
So they've got a 9 by 9 foot space, which is divided into 16 squares. Now, that's just so they could, like, sort of look at where the baby's going, right? So they've got a 4 by 4 sort of separation of these squares, right? So baby's in 1A, and then baby moves. Oh, now baby's in 2A.
Like, you know, a game of chess.
Yeah.
Baby
to
2A.
When I make my move.
Dear me. So that was just to track where the babies were going. So there was a chair that had toys on it, and there was another set of chairs for the mother and the stranger. Now, the stranger was a stranger to the baby. Baby did not know the stranger, as is probably explanatory by the name. So the baby's put in the middle. The mother and the stranger basically given a set of instructions that they've got to follow out over the sort of course of the experiment. So the kid basically plays for 20 minutes. And the caregivers and strangers come in and out of the room, basically just sort of how the idea behind this is sort of to like replicate what the kid's life might actually be, right? The kid is playing in a room, a stranger's coming in and out, a caregiver's coming in and out. The kid's kind of left their own devices for a little bit whilst they're playing, but it's not a terribly unfamiliar or unrealistic, rather, situation for a child to be in.
Mm-hmm. No, mum goes to the toilet.
Mums go to the toilet?
Mm, they piss too.
Wow. Yeah.
Thank goodness I've learned something today.
Ouch. they basically were on the sort of scientists were on the other side of like a one-way mirror, you know? One-way mirror? Yeah, one-way mirror. People say two-way mirror, and I'm like, that's a window. That's what that is. They're on the other side of a one-way mirror, so they could watch the kids without the kids knowing that they're being watched, right? Because, crucially, if the kid is able to see
a room full of strangers,
yeah, watching them, it's probably going to influence their behavior. So the kid plays for 20 minutes, they sit and watch that, and then there are different sort of things that go on, different sort of episodes it's described as in my notes. So the first one, mother, baby, and experimenter. So the mum takes the baby into the room and with an observer walking in with them. Then the observer leaves, and that's less than a minute, right? So basically, they walk in together with the mum and the baby, and then the observer, they go, they leave. And then the mum is alone with the baby. That's the second one. She puts the baby in a designated area and then sits quietly, only interacting if the baby initiates. Again, I'm reading this verbatim. You can find all our sources in the description. That's 3 minutes. Then number three, the stranger joins the mother and infant. So stranger comes in, sits quietly for a minute, then starts chatting with the mum for another minute before kind of getting up close to the baby, holding up a little toy, you know, as you do. After the third minute, the mum leaves the room, but it's sort of specified as discreetly, so it's not like she's making a big old fuss about it. She's kind of like, you know, just like,
I'll be gone then. I hope you're okay without me.
So the baby doesn't notice, essentially, right? Like,
cry.
So the baby's playing, mind you. What do you think the sort of outcomes could be here if, you know, all of these things have happened? We're at the point where the mother has discreetly left the room and the baby is playing, not necessarily having immediately noticed that the mother is gone.
Well, it depends on the baby, really.
Yeah,
if it's a baby whose mummy's not that nice, it's probably more scared of strangers because it probably doesn't have that much trust in them. So if a baby is scared of strangers, baby won't have a very good time alone with a stranger. But if a baby... but you said earlier, if a baby has cried, mum doesn't come, stops crying, doesn't care anymore, maybe if a baby is so detached from its mother, it will make best friends with a stranger.
Maybe, actually.
If they ran this experiment like so far that all the babies decided to be adopted by the stranger.
You gotta go home with a stranger now. This is your new...
The baby looks up at the mum like, I don't even know you anymore. Get
it'd
out
be really embarrassing as the parent, you know, to walk in like with the baby and have to leave, like go home to your family baby. And be like, so baby chose someone else.
This is actually a sting operation for a bunch of people who didn't have babies but wanted babies.
So if the baby was happy playing, the stranger did nothing, the baby sort of wasn't doing anything, just kind of went sort of quiet, the stranger would start to try to get them playing with the toys, and the baby started to, you know, cry, the stranger would then try to soothe them. If they couldn't soothe the baby, they would stop the experiment. They would stop that section there. Mm-hmm. Stop that episode. If the baby was fine, like after being comforted or whatnot, they would carry on that on for 3 minutes. Then the mother comes back and the stranger leaves. So the mum comes in, stops in the doorway, and then the baby, the baby reacts to the mum being in the doorway.
Hello.
And then the stranger like kind of leaves again discreetly. And the mother basically, she's not told what to do. I mean, again, reading verbatim from my notes, the subsequent actions of the mother were not predetermined except for the instructions that once the baby resumed playing with the toys, she would leave again, pausing to say, Bye bye. So this episode lasted basically as long as it needed to. But you can kind of see, you're kind of building up a picture of what's going on here, right? So we put a baby in an environment, we get them to sort of play, get to understand the environment a little bit. They've seen the stranger as they're entering this place. And then they've been kind of tested just a little bit with like the caregiver, the mother, leaving briefly and then coming back and then announcing, you know, that she's leaving again.
I'm off.
I guess I'll be back at some point if anyone cares.
If you get.
So after that point, the mother leaves and the baby's left completely alone. So bear in mind, up until here, we're sort of, we've gone up past episode 5. So we've gone from the mother and the baby and the experimenter entering and then the mother and baby being left alone. And then a stranger joining the mother and the baby, and then the mother discreetly leaving whilst the stranger's left alone with the baby. And now the mother's back with the baby and the stranger's left. And then episode 6 is where we just got to. The mother leaves and the infant is by themselves, right? They're left alone. Now, they're left for 3 minutes or shorter, depending on how upset they get. Because again, as I said, this experiment actually seemed to care a little bit about the well-being of the infants that they were using. And then episode 7, the stranger returns. Basically, they come back, the stranger, without the mother. So the baby is now in the room alone with the stranger. And again, they just do this for 3 minutes or shorter if the baby gets too upset. And then verbatim from my notes, once the mother and child reunion is noted, the scenario is concluded, right? So essentially what they've done here is put the baby in a bunch of different situations to kind of see how they react. They've tracked their movement. They've seen that they're playing. They've seen if they can be soothed by others. And the way that we sort of look at this is the caregiver is a secure base, right? So we can kind of see that they've gone through a few different sort of scenarios in this experiment to kind of see how the baby reacts to being left alone with a stranger, you know, the mother leaving, all of these sorts of things, right? And now the idea is that while, yeah, the kid is probably going to be at least a little bit upset by being left alone, how they react to that and how they sort of self-soothe and how they respond to these situations gives you an idea of sort of the kid's attachment style, right? So the difference between how they react is based on these sort of attachment types, like I've said. If you've got securely attached kids, they'll reduce their negative emotions by using their caregivers, right? So you need a secure base and they'll get back to doing whatever pretty quickly once the, you know, the strange situation has concluded. So with these kids, you know, they'll be upset maybe once their mother's gone. They'll be soothed once their mother's back, but they'll be pretty quick in getting back to playing because they're like, oh, cool, you're here. I'm fine, right?
Oh, it's all good. Come back.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's almost like that sort of trust or faith there, right? You've got anxious-resistant children. Do you know anything about anxious-resistant or anxious-avoidant? Those are two different categories, by the way.
Anxious-resistant. They're anxious about everything. They're scared of strangers, scared of their parents moving, but also not moving. They're scared of strangers. They're scared of their parents leaving, but also not that helped by their parents returning.
Yeah, no. So that's it. They basically stay upset, say distressed, they can have sort of negative reactions to to their caregivers once they've returned as well, right? So it's like, okay, you've left, I'm upset, you're back, I'm still upset, why did you leave?
Obviously. They hold grudges.
No, yeah.
They hold grudges.
Yes.
Well, they're trying to teach the parent, like, you actually aren't allowed to leave. I'm going to be a real bitch about it if you leave.
Here are the repercussions of your actions, mom.
So, I love the jokes. I'm loving the fun. I want to be clear to anyone that's listening that that's not why babies are doing that, because they're spiteful.
But some babies are just dicks. Like, they're just rude.
So, yeah, the baby will stay upset if it's anxious-resistant and they'll have some resentment towards their caregiver. Anxious-avoidant children, do you know anything about the anxious-avoidant?
Oh, God, their mood is not determined by what their parents are doing. Their mum will leave, they'll be like, meh. Mum will come back, they'll be like, meh.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're not outwardly, they don't show as much sort of outward emotion to them. You can see sort of elevated heart rates, sort of things like that, but not the sort of visible necessarily crying and screaming and those obvious signs of distress. You're so right. They will just stay sort of, they'll keep them at arm's length, right? They'll keep the caregiver kind of at arm's length.
It's not very far.
Well,
don't touch me.
for a baby.
Stay away!
For a baby, that's very far. You've got to, they're very small. But no, they're kind of the more self, sort of, you know, self-starters, the self-reliant types, the ones that kind of are more independent is the word I'm looking for. Yeah. So those are the three main categories. I think there's another category as well, but I don't really want to get into that because it wasn't super covered in this experiment, but there is sort of, how do I put it? It's kind of an all over the place one. Essentially, the fourth type.
Right, insecure attached.
Disorganized, I think it's described. And that's more sort of when a caregiver is sort of the source of sort of discomfort or distress. But also, what do you do when the thing that you want to soothe you is the thing that's making you need to be soothed? Do you know what I mean?
Mummy shouts at me, but she also feeds me and puts me to bed. But she's also mean to me, but I kind of need her.
Yeah, basically that. And so then the you know, you can understand how that would result in a disorganized attachment style, right? You basically just, you don't have resolution to things, and it's this sort of really conflicting, contradictory, confusing sort of situation for an infant to be in.
Oh my God, commitment issues as an adult, right?
Yeah, I mean, potentially, yeah. And so that's where you're kind of getting into how these attachment styles as children get into adult relationships. I'll just go through the sort of attachment styles again, just to make it clearer. So in that 1970 sort of study, they had three attachment styles. The ones I went through just earlier, they're type A, B, and C. So type B would be secure, insecure, avoidant would be type A, and insecure, ambivalent, slash resistant would be type C. So we would now probably describe those as secure, anxious, resistant, and anxious, avoidant. And basically, if we just run through kind of what goes on with the secure type, they are sort of distressed when the mother leaves, and they're sort of cautious around the stranger when the mother isn't there, but when the mother is there, they're more adventurous, they're more exploratory, they're more friendly to the stranger, right? And when the mother returns, they're happy to see the mother, right? So on the reunion, they're like, "Oh, you're back. Mm. Nice. I was scared. Now I'm less so. Glad you're here. Glad to be with you." And then basically, the idea here is that what we're talking about, the secure base, the safe base, that sort of thing, having the sort of parent as an anchor, and using them to find comfort and sort of to have the sort of, you know, confidence to explore unfamiliar situations. And then if we look at the resistant type, the sort of type C, ambivalent resistant or anxious resistant, that would be really like a lot of distress when the mother's gone, avoiding the stranger, like to the point of being scared of them. And then when they're reunited with the mother, kind of getting closer, but not really properly reuniting. In my notes, it quite literally says the infant approaches the mother but resists contact, may even push her away. And yeah, when we move on to the anxious avoidant, that's when the mum leaves, they're chilling. They're like, "Yeah,
see ya.
Whatevs. I'm good. I ain't crying. I ain't stressed out." Basically, no obvious signs of distress when the mother leaves, right? And when the stranger's there, the infant's like, "Fine." Like, when the stranger's there, they're just playing. It doesn't really make much of a difference to them. They're like, I'm not bothered. I'm going to keep on doing my thing. And then when they're reunited with the mother, as we said, just don't really seem to care all that much, right? And so another thing on this as well is that the mother and stranger can soothe the avoidant, the anxious avoidant type equally well. So when the mother leaves, right, and the stranger's alone with the kid, and if the kid is upset, then, you know, the stranger can soothe the kid about as well as the mother can soothe the kid.
Yeah, you're as good for me as a complete stranger.
Yeah,
thanks,
basically,
Mom.
Basically. And so that breaks down as 70% of them were secure, 15 were resistant, and 15 were avoidant. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and we've already gone into the fourth attachment style, disorganized. That was found in 1990, so about 20 years afterwards. And again, that's more in a sort of situation where the caregiver is also the cause of a lot of distress. So it's kind of an outlier of those ones. It operates a little bit differently. But then in the mid-1980s, that's when we kind of started talking about attachment styles relating to adults, like you were mentioning there.
They were smart in the 80s. That's what I heard about them. I feel like because I learned about this while I was in school, I was so interested in it. Obviously, don't remember everything. But now anytime I see anybody behave in a specific way, I'm like, oh, bad relationship with your parents. It's like, oh, you're a bit too secure. You've had your needs met. But yeah, no, I
too look, secure.
But then I also feel like if I met someone and asked them, I could guess. Mm. Like I feel like I'm not a scientist, but like it defo has an impact, right?
I mean, yeah, it can have an impact, right? That is the interesting thing. It's the question is sort of how much of an impact does it have, and sort of how long does that impact last?
Yeah, it's interesting because the naming of it is kind of funny because, like, for example, when it says secure, the secure, quote-unquote secure, baby is actually quite insecure in that the parent leaves and they're like, that's not being secure, but it's to do with attachment style. Whereas the kind of ambivalent, uncaring parents here, parents not there, whatever, I don't care, that on the surface looks like a secure baby because they're like, the parent will come back, everything's going to be fine. Whereas actually it's probably on a deeper level, like, it makes no difference to me. I'm so used to my parent not being here or for me that I've given up caring. Ultimately, what's most important here is how that ripples down into your behavior and your attachment in adulthood. Mm-hmm. Because probably, I would guess, the child that actually is emotionally vulnerable as a baby, i.e. parent leaves and they cry, which is fine because you're a baby, you can't do anything, ends up being the secure adult, whereas the kind of oddly self-secure child, i.e. like they can kind of look after themselves, they don't really care. I imagine that doesn't lead, even though they were so like self-reliant as a baby, and you'd think that they'd be self-reliant in adulthood, it actually is a manifestation of an insecurity as opposed to a security, which is weird.
I assume they probably just like push people away. So they're like, I don't need anyone. I've got myself.
Sigma male.
Sigma male.
I think the key point to sort of bear in mind with this is that the baby isn't sort of not distressed, the avoidant style. It's not that it isn't distressed. It's that it's not showing outward signs of it, right?
Because there's no point, I guess. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, exactly, right? It's got to the point where it's like, well, it doesn't make a difference whether I do this or not. And again, it's really difficult to apply this sort of mind. It's like applying this sort of mindset to animals, right? Babies aren't necessarily going to be thinking like that. But the key thing to take away there is that there are these internal signs of distress. You know, like you can see that the baby is distressed if you sort of check their heart rate or whatever. But you're not going to see that they're distressed by just watching them with the naked
eye. That's so sad because it's almost like they've given up. Like if you imagine the baby is like born, obviously this is me hypothesizing, me saying nonsense probably, I don't know. But if you imagine the baby is born with a few things that it's trying to sort of regulate to a certain extent, like it's trying to regulate food, have I eaten, am I hungry, am I warm, like really basic things. And one of those things might be, what's my proximity to my caregiver? If it's just like, the proximity to the caregiver, it might be like being monitored, like it's aware of where the caregiver is. Like you say, it still has raised heart rate. It's just that it feels like there's nothing I can do. The proximity of the caregiver, it might be far, it might be near, but when I cry, nothing changes.
Yeah.
So I give up trying to regulate that specific thing.
Yeah.
Which is so sad.
It's really sad, isn't it? Yeah. It sounds really sad.
Yeah.
And the way that you're sort of talking about the secure baby sort of crying when the caregiver leaves, I think to view that less as like, oh, I am the only one that's distressed, and more as a sort of like, I am distressed, and so I'm going to do the thing that I do when I'm distressed, which is call out for help.
Yeah.
That's essentially what it is, right? A baby crying is just like, help me, please. Help me. Help. I need help. That's what's happening, right? And I think the key interaction to look at there is when the parent sort of returns or the caregiver returns, right? With the secure type, they're then soothed by the parent. And they're chill to explore when the parent's there. But with the sort of avoidant type, they're like, you know, I mean, when the parent returns or the caregiver returns, there isn't that sort of any positive thing with the reunion. And with the sort of, what's the other one, the anxious resistant type, they sort of will push back against the caregiver returning, right? And so you can see that if we, like, maybe on the surface of it, depending on how you describe it, the secure type could sound less independent or less healthy than you know, the avoidant type. But ultimately, when it comes to relationships, we are social animals. When it comes to relationships, the secure type seems to be, well, the secure type is the best one of the three, right?
And it's a baby.
A baby.
It's okay to be a baby for a bit. Like, yeah. You're useless, and that's fine. You're a baby.
No, so how this sort of affects adults is we kind of look at it mostly in terms of romantic relationships. And, you know, it kind of makes some kind of sense there, right? That if you've got, like, a strong bond between you and your partner, you kind of rely on them in sort of not necessarily similar ways, but there are similarities in those relationships.
It's
right?
Like trust.
Trust, yeah. Mm. But also, you know, again, my notes, I've got some great examples here that I'll just read out for you. Close intimate body contact, feeling insecure when the other is inaccessible, sharing discoveries with each other, sort of feeling safe when the other is nearby and responsive, right? These are things that are consistent between infants and caregivers and often people in adult romantic relationships.
I'm always sharing discoveries with my wife.
No, but like,
I learned this thing today and I'm going to talk about it too much.
I think that's something else, but yeah. And another one that I thought was really funny is baby talk, right? Adults, well, baby talk people into relationships.
Yeah, God,
with.
People hate this so much. Yeah, what's that a symptom of?
Well, I don't know. It's just, oh, right. It's just similarities. Okay. Of
There was this girl in sixth form when I was in school, my first year of senior school in the boarding house, and every single night her boyfriend would come around and everyone would be like, "Oh, that's Nikki." Her and her boyfriend speak to each other really weird, and I was like, "What?" They were literally like, "I love you, Henry. You're looking so pretty today, Henry." Yeah.
Don't do that in front of people.
They're so securely attached, it makes me want to vom. Horrible.
So that was, I think, Shazan and Shaver that kind of brought up these similarities there between, you know, romantic relationships and infant caregiver relationships. And the kind of where this goes is, right, well, if these relationships are similar, how much influence does the, you know, attachment style as a child, as an infant, how much influence does that have on your attachment style as an adult? And I mean, what do you both think? Like, what would you hypothesize in this situation?
I'd say that it has a lot of impact on it, but then also it doesn't really account for the fact that, like, between being a baby and being an adult in a relationship, there are tons of things that can happen in your life that completely put you off course.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And what we kind of see there is that if you're sort of secure, that would generally mean that from your previous experiences, you know that, like, well, if I just follow the rules, like, quite literally it's described as the rules in my notes here, basically you can just say, "Hey, I have a problem, and I would like this to be dealt with," then you know that you feel secure that that will lead to the problem being solved, right? Mm. And what that essentially can result in is healthy communication, right? So if you've got your the person that you've got you're sort of attached to, right? So let's say this is a parent-child relationship, like a caregiver sort of infant relationship, or a romantic relationship, right? That partner or that parent is sort of the person that you bring your discomforts to, right? And they support you and they comfort you. That's what you want out of a partner and what you want out of a parent, right? Someone that you could be like, "Hey, I have this problem. Like, I have a problem." And they help you, they comfort you, they help you feel better about it, right? That's something that you would generally want, and secure individuals feel literally just secure and comfortable in bringing those things up, which could result, as I said, in better communication. And communication is
key. Everything wonderful,
cool,
yeah. All of those. And if you're avoidant, how do you think that might affect adult relationships? Like, how do you think avoidant folk might react?
Oh,
well, I mean, so too many ways to count, I guess, but like things like not trusting the other person, or being clingy of the other person, or oh God, too many. There's so many.
Pushing them away, yeah. Being like, "I don't need you, even though I do."
Yeah, yes. So avoidant is generally like, I have had to deal with my own things, and you've essentially learned, right, well, no one else is going to help me, I'm going to help myself. And so it can lead to bottling up of sort of problems, or sort of like essentially trying to stop like bad things from happening when they happen. So again, in my notes, the use of self-reliant tactics to control and reduce negative affect when it arises. So basically any negative sort of responses that you get from others, just trying to limit that as much as possible.
But then there's also, I think, almost the opposite as well sometimes, where like you so expect someone's going to run away that you almost drive them away like, so that you have control over it? Isn't that a thing? Like,
yeah, essentially it's like trying to minimize distress as much as possible. And if you're doing that by being
love,
like,
love me.
What? This is what the first 6 months was like. But if you're trying to limit distress as much as possible, then yeah, you can drive other people away or just keep a distance, especially if, you know, if you've got emotional issues, if you don't want to communicate those, because, you know, the way that you are supposed to deal with those, with this mindset is, you know, just avoiding the problem, essentially. Highly avoidant adults, right? Like, that's what we're talking about. It's kind of in the name. And when it comes to anxious folk, that's essentially basically like worrying that attachment figures will never fully meet their persistent needs for comfort and support, right? So just like focusing on the thing that's bothering them, like thinking about it, ruminating on it. I've got in my notes, and yeah, just worrying, like essentially anxiety. It's all in the name there, essentially, right? So secure, if you think of that as being able to like communicate the problems, like, and feeling comfortable that communicating the problems is going to solve them. Avoidant is more like sort of self-sufficient, in terms of like, I can just deal with this on my own. No, you can't. You're a person. You need other people to help you deal with things. And sort of, essentially just being independent to a fault, almost, right? And then anxious people, just get anxious, get stressed about these things, and don't necessarily actually resolve anything. Get stressed about people not being able to resolve things, just like never feeling safe or comfortable or secure. Yeah.
When you're talking about like feeling like you can voice a thing and you'll be like supported, like you can share your feelings. One of my favorite like YouTube short subgenres is like these sketches of like, in the sketch I saw, it's like this lady going to speak to her partner and being like, this is a thing you're doing that's upsetting me. And then the partner being like, oh, that's totally understandable and valid. Like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Let's talk about it. And then her being like, what? Are you not going to tell me I'm stupid and my feelings are invalid? And then be like, no. And then all the comments are just like, this is so nice. It just feels so warm.
I mean, and it's really like, we do see that there is sort of an effect on happiness and whatnot there, right? So if you're securely attached, you're more likely to experience positive emotions in romantic relationships, and fewer negative emotions compared to the other groups. And sort of your early attachment pattern does have an influence, as we said, on your sort of attachment style later in life, but it's not sort of set in stone. Yeah. There are things that can change it, and I think the way to view this is not sort of your style is set when you're an infant, but more so that your methods of dealing with these sort of situations, dealing with these sort of emotional attachments or these relationships, is informed by your experiences. And so if your past experiences result in you, you know, sort of sort of being more avoidant or more anxious, then that's probably what you're going to be like. But different experiences can change that. You know, it's not like horoscopes. It's more like something else.
You are balanced.
Presumably you're given like the biggest, like the nudge in the strongest direction in your childhood. And then, you know, experiences you have can nudge you off the course that was set when you were a child, and you can very much get to a healthier, in a healthier direction. So it's not set in stone, like you say, but like, because it's like experiences you had in the past are informing you how you will experience things in the future, the things that happened furthest in the past or when you were like least capable of complex thought are probably going to have the largest effect, like the or an outsize effect. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I think so, but maybe more in the sense that like, not this is the biggest thing, and so this is going to affect you forever necessarily, but potentially more in a sense of, this is the thing that has informed you, and so it's going to continue informing you until something changes.
Is it like it's like the automatic response that you have to unlearn?
I guess, yeah. But I mean, there are also studies that say the link between these two things isn't, you know, incredibly strong. Like, we can see that there is a link between these things, but thinking of them as, as you were saying earlier, Noah, where you're like, you see someone's how someone is, and you're like, well, I know what your childhood was like. Yeah. You can't be that sort of predictive on it necessarily, right?
Wow.
We're kind of
calling you out.
Well, it's just the
maybe your childhood, or maybe you had a bad relationship later in life.
Well, I think it's, you know, having a sort of predictive model about the sort of continuous relationship between those sort of attachment styles, right, between romantic partners and sort of between parents and infants, it's not as easy to sort of figure that out, right? We do think there is a link, but whether or not that is, well, this means this, absolutely, that's still a bit unclear. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, you know, if you, I'm not saying that, you know, if your parent was like this, then you're definitely not going to be like this in relationships. Yeah, it's going to have some effect, but it's not as simple as saying, this is how you are now, therefore that is what happened to you then.
I think it's also very important to say that just because things like that happening in your childhood, which are obviously outside of your control, have an effect on you as an adult, that doesn't then later excuse bad behavior as an adult. Because I think often if you're trying to make someone's behavior make sense and you go back and imagine them, oh, well, it must have been because you were this little helpless poor baby, you can end up excusing people's adult behavior, which is not the right way of thinking about that.
I agree. I think trauma is an explanation. It's never an excuse, you know, and I find that a lot of people struggle with that, especially when, you know, it comes to, I don't want to say bad behavior, but sort of maladaptive behavior, let's say, or like harmful behavior to others. It can be really difficult for people to sort of, you know, see someone saying, hey, this thing that you're doing is not good, I don't like it, and not take it as a personal sort of but this is from trauma, and that means that it hurts my feelings to hear this. You can't. No, like trauma is.
My mom said this when I was a baby, and you're trying to tell me that I shouldn't react like the way I did towards my mother.
Yeah.
When I was a baby.
No, absolutely, and that's the really difficult thing, right? Because it takes that sort of. You're not going to be able to get out of those behaviors without sort of like actually understanding that the way that you're reacting is not a way that you should be reacting, right? I find that people sort of say, "Oh, this is a trauma response," as though it's like. As though it's a
full stop.
That's it. And now it's an excusable thing. No, if you treat other people poorly, you should make efforts to not do that, regardless of why you treat other people poorly. Because I hate to break it to you, it's not like there are just a bunch of really horrible, evil people in the world, and you're the only one that only does bad things to people because you had trauma in your past or whatever, or even trauma in your present. No, a lot of people are messed up in a lot of different ways. And a lot of people either intentionally treat people poorly or unintentionally treat people poorly. It's not as simple as just divvying people up into good and bad.
Insecure attachment, avoidant, anxious, secure attachment.
But Your Honor, my client has an insecure attachment style. Oh, okay, right. Sorry, I didn't realize.
He wasn't hugged as a child.
But like, exactly though, right? And I feel like, you know, and it's interesting coming into this, and I think finding out that there actually is a lot more science behind this than a lot of the other things that people are using to sort of give themselves Hogwarts houses or whatever, right? But I think there needs to be sort of caution with this, right? Because when we start viewing attachment styles as a definitive sort of section grouping for humanity, we kind of fall into a trap, right? Attachment styles don't exist. Attachment styles are an easy way of explaining and grouping together different responses that people have. And it's not as though these responses are sort of like, you are definitively this, right? Like, it's...
We can predict your behavior based on this category that you might be part of.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like you tend to have this kind of reaction, and so this sort of more neatly fits this group, and if we put you in this group, yeah, there are some things that we can maybe potentially figure out about other areas of your life or how you might react to different situations, right? It's not about distinct groups that actually 100% definitely exist and humans just sort of happen to fall into one of the four. We made the groups up to describe how people are. And when you start sort of being like, oh, he's this, he's secure attached, or he's this and that, you should only be using it in a way to sort of elucidate behavior or like understand things, not as a sort of like this is an identity that you hold.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Also, there are like other things that could determine different groups. Like some cultures raise children as a community rather than having like one primary caregiver. Some kids are autistic and maybe don't want to hug their mother.
Yeah.
Like, you can, these aren't categories that, like, categorize the entire world. There are so many things that could, like...
Absolutely, you're so... And I'm glad you brought up different cultures as well, because, you know, as mentioned earlier, these studies were done, you know, the first studies were done with American middle-class folk, right?
Mm.
And there are plenty of things, yes, you're saying there, Noah, like, raising, you know, kids in a community. Plenty of things that could change that. And that is something else that happens a lot in science, wherein we look at a very specific group of people and we sort of say, this is how everyone is. And yeah, maybe this only describes middle-class Americans. Maybe it only describes middle-class white people from a certain part of the, you know, the world. Maybe it describes every single person on the planet, right? Yeah, it is probably, you know, there are probably different variations that we might find in different cultures. And yeah, that's kind of the key point, right? That like, you don't want to view this as a Hogwarts house, because that's ridiculous.
Because those 30. Are real and definite, and you can't be divergent.
Harry Potter was divergent. He chose to be a Gryffindor.
Yeah.
He could have been. I don't, but like, seriously, right? Also, if he was a Slytherin, Voldemort would have been down like that. Like, I mean, in 10 minutes, honestly, right? Like, that's the ambition there. But seriously, it's not Hogwarts houses. It's not sort of something that determines what your identity is. It's just an easier way of understanding the world by grouping a lot of vaguely similar people together, right?
Just quickly on that, what you said there, it's so fascinating how many of our studies would have to be caveated, especially up until 5 or 10 years ago when we started getting a little bit better at this, with like the caveat of like, this is not how humans behave or how humans behave always. This is like how humans behave in a nuclear family, probably straight family, in a capitalist system in the Western world with one primary caregiver, probably in the 70s, who's probably a woman, and the other one is not around as much because they're working all the time, and when they're not working, they're tired. Like, there's so many caveats, and we don't really know how a human would behave outside of all of those extra sort of clarifications.
No, absolutely. And just from a quick look, it seems that attachment styles are kind of consistent across cultures, but the sort of percentage makeup of each one is different. Across all cultures, though, secure attachment style is the most common one, sort of invariably.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah, well, I think I've seen from 50 to 75%, depending on where you go. I think Britain wasn't doing... Look, it doesn't really matter.
oh, no.
All I'm saying is that, yeah, I mean, you got to think more broadly when it comes to a lot of these topics, right? And yeah, I don't super love seeing people say things like, oh, I wouldn't date this person with that attachment style, or like, yeah, they're doing this because of that attachment style, and sort of writing off people's behavior or writing off people in a certain way because of that, because again, I don't think we should be using those in that way. This is something that we can use to understand broadly how infants react, and then again, kind of broadly to understand how people might interact in relationships. But there are so many variables going on, right? There are so many things that influence a person and so many different things that can happen within a relationship that like being like, oh, this is your attachment style. Out of how many people are there? Like 7 billion, 8 billion like people, right? Let's round up to 8 billion. There are 8 billion people. You splitting them into 4 different groups and you're making judgments on that?
I mean, we've split them into 2.
two and a bit.
I feel like that's worse.
It is worse. It is much worse. Yeah. And so, Noah, what group is that you're talking about? Short and tall. Get rid of the short tall divide now.
Give me stilts.
Redistribute the height.
But yeah, no. I mean, it's a difficult thing when you've got something that kind of describes groups of people, and people start using that to be maybe a little bit more specific than they should be.
It describes babies well. In those current moments.
Yeah, that's true. But bear in mind that when it comes to babies, we can't ask them how they're feeling, and we can only really see how they're feeling by measuring their heart rate and seeing if they cry or not. So splitting them into 4 groups is probably... It makes sense, right? If you were to ask the babies how they felt, maybe there'd be more groups, you know?
More people should do that, I think. They should ask.
Right. Well, on that note, I think it's time for the quickfire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Attachment style edition.
So the rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after finished answer the question wins. What do they win, Luke?
They win me coming back into the room and giving them a hug.
And what is your buzzer?
Ah!
And what is your buzzer?
Wah!
Very good. So my question for you is, Name three of the attachment styles. Question mark.
Luke. Anxious. Avoidant.
Mm.
Secure.
Mm.
And detached. No. No.
Noah, if you can name literally one more.
Disorganized.
Yeah, there we go. Ding, ding, ding. Well done, Noah. You win a hug from Luke after he comes back in, after he comes back in the room.
I'm already back in the room.
Okay. Okay, well, I think that's pretty much all from us. Noah, is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I just finished a tour with Enter Shikari, which was really cool. But if you're watching from America or Canada, I'm on tour very soon. Buy a ticket.
Yeah.
You heard him, and that's all from us. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with an extra special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit, and thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe to new episodes every Monday, and why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Instagram on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
You can follow me to Noah's tour in America. Where I won't be, but you will be.
You can follow me at NoFence everywhere apart from Twitter, where it's NoFedAdams, and TikTok, where it's TheNoFence.
Buy a ticket.
Buy it.
Bye-bye. I'm leaving the room now. Try not to cry about it. I'll see you later.
I'll be off. If you care.